The Horse Whisperer, Disc 5.
Annie was talking with Connie in the kitchen when Elliot came in from the yard. He looked pale and had mud all down one side of him. He also seemed to be trying not to limp. "I left him in the trailer," he said. At supper, Grace toyed with her food and spoke only when spoken to. The three adults did their best to keep the conversation going, but there were long spells when the only sound was the chink of cutlery. They talked about Harry Logan and Chatham and a new outbreak of Lyme disease that everyone was worrying about. Elliot said they knew a young girl about Grace's age who'd caught it and her life had been completely wrecked. Connie darted a look at him, and he flushed a little and quickly changed the subject. As soon as the meal was over, Grace said she was tired and would they mind if she went to bed. Annie said she would come too, but Grace wouldn't let her. She said polite goodnights to Elliot and Connie. As she walked to the door, her cane clunked on the hollow floor, and Annie caught the look in the couple's eyes as they watched. The next day, yesterday, they'd made an early start and driven with just a few short stops all the way across Indiana and Illinois and on into Iowa. And all day long, as the vast continent opened up around them, Grace kept her silence. Last night, they'd stayed with a distant cousin of Liz Hammond, who'd married a farmer and lived near Des Moines. The farm stood alone at the end of 5 straight miles of driveway, as if on its own brown planet, plowed in faultless furrows to every horizon. They were quiet, religious folk, Baptists, Annie guessed, and as unlike Liz as she could imagine. The farmer said Liz had told them all about Pilgrim, but Annie could see he was still shocked by what he saw. He helped her feed and water the horse, and then raked out and replaced as much of the wet, dung-soiled straw as he could from under Pilgrim's thrashing hooves. They ate supper at a long wooden table with the couple's 6 children. They all had their father's blonde hair and wide blue eyes and watched Annie and Grace with a kind of polite wonder. The food was plain and wholesome, and there was only milk to drink, served creamy and still warm from the dairy in brimming glass jugs. This morning, the wife had cooked them a breakfast of eggs, hash browns, and home-cured ham, and just as they were leaving, with Grace already in the car, the farmer had handed something to Annie. "We'd like you to have this," he said. It was an old book with a faded cloth cover. The man's wife was standing beside him, and they watched as Annie opened it. It was The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. Annie could remember it being read to her at school when she was only 7 or 8 years old. "It seemed appropriate," the farmer said. Annie swallowed and thanked him. "We'll be praying for you all," the woman said. The book still lay on the front passenger seat, and every time Annie caught sight of it, she thought about the woman's words. Even though Annie had lived in this country for many years, such candid religious talk still jolted some deep-seated English reserve in her and made her feel uneasy. But what disturbed her more was that this total stranger had so clearly seen them all as needing her prayers. She'd seen them as victims. Not just Pilgrim and Grace, that was understandable, but Annie too. Nobody ever had seen Annie Graves that way. Now, below the lightning on the horizon, something caught her eye. It started as little more than a flickering speck and grew slowly as she watched it, assembling itself into the liquid shape of a truck. Soon, beyond it, she could see the towers of grain elevators, then other lower buildings, a town sprouting up around them. A flurry of small brown birds erupted from the side of the road and were buffeted away on the wind. The truck was nearly up to them now, and Annie watched the glinting chrome of its grill get larger and larger until it passed them in a blast of wind that made the car and trailer shudder. Grace stirred behind her. "What was that?" "Nothing, just a truck." Annie saw her in the mirror, rubbing sleep from her eyes. "There's a town coming up. We need gas. Are you hungry?"
"A little."
The exit road traveled in a long loop around a white wooden church that stood on its own in a field of dead grass. In front of it, a small boy with a bicycle watched them circle by, and as they did, the church was suddenly engulfed in sunshine. Annie half expected to see a finger pointing down through the clouds. There was a diner next to the gas station, and after filling up, they ate egg salad sandwiches in silence, surrounded by men who wore baseball caps emblazoned with the names of farm products and who spoke in hushed tones of winter wheat and the price of soybeans. For all Annie understood, they might as well have been speaking some foreign tongue. She went to pay the check, then came back to the table to tell Grace she was going to the restroom and would meet her back at the car. "Would you see if Pilgrim wants some water?" she said. Grace didn't answer. "Grace, did you hear me?" Annie stood over her, aware suddenly that the farmers around them had stopped talking. The confrontation was deliberate, but now she regretted the impulse to make it so public. Grace didn't look up. She finished her Coke, and the sound her glass made when she put it down punctuated the silence. "Do it yourself," she said. The first time Grace had thought about killing herself was in the cab coming home that day from the prosthetist's. The socket of the false leg had dug into the underside of her thigh bone, but she'd pretended it felt fine and had gone along with her father's determined cheerfulness while wondering which would be the best way to do it. 2 years ago, a girl in eighth grade had thrown herself under a downtown express on the subway. No one seemed able to come up with a reason for it, and like everyone else, Grace had been shocked. But she had also been secretly impressed. What courage it must have taken, she thought, in that final decisive moment. Grace remembered thinking she herself could never summon such courage, and that even if she could, her muscles would somehow still refuse to make that last launching flex. Now, though, she saw it in an altogether different light, and could contemplate the possibility, if not the particular method, with what amounted to dispassion. That her life was ruined was a simple fact, only reinforced by the way those around her sought so fervently to show it wasn't. She wished with all her heart that she had died that day with Judith and Gulliver in the snow. But as the weeks went by, she realized, and it came to her almost as a disappointment, that maybe she wasn't the suicide type. What held her back was the inability to see it only from her own point of view. It seemed so melodramatic, so extravagant, more the sort of extremist thing her mother might do. It didn't occur to Grace that perhaps it was the McLean in her, those cursed lawyer genes, that made her so objectify the issue of her own demise. For blame had ever flowed but one way in this family. Everything was always Annie's fault. Grace loved and resented her mother in almost equal measure, and often for the same thing. For her certainty, for example, and for the way she was always so damn right. Above all, for knowing Grace the way she did. Knowing how she would react to things, what her likes and dislikes were, what her opinion might be on any given subject. Maybe all mothers had such insight on their daughters, and sometimes it was wonderful to be so understood. More often, though, and especially of late, it felt like a monstrous invasion of her privacy. For these, and 1,000 less specific wrongs, Grace now took revenge. For at last, with this great silence, she seemed to have a weapon that worked. She could see the effect it was having on her mother and found it gratifying. Annie's acts of tyranny were normally executed without a hint of guilt or self-doubt. But now Grace sensed both. There seemed some tacit and exploitable acknowledgement that it was wrong to have forced Grace to join this escapade. Viewed from the back seat of the Lariat, her mother seemed like some gambler, staking life itself on one last desperate spin of the wheel. They drove due west to the Missouri, then swung north, with the rivers snaking broad and brown to their left. At Sioux City, they crossed into South Dakota and headed west again on Route 90, which would take them all the way to Montana. They passed through the northern Badlands and saw the sun go down over the Black Hills in a strip of blood-orange sky. They traveled without speaking, and the brooding sorrow between them seemed to spawn and spread until it mingled with the million other sorrows that haunted this vast, unforgiving landscape. Neither Liz nor Harry knew anyone who lived in these parts, so Annie had booked a room at a small hotel near Mount Rushmore. She had never seen the monument and had looked forward to coming here with Grace. But when they pulled into the hotel's deserted parking lot, it was dark and raining, and Annie thought the only good thing about being there was that she wouldn't have to make polite conversation with hosts she'd never met and would never meet again. The rooms were all named after different presidents. Theirs was Abraham Lincoln. His beard jutted at them from laminated prints on every wall, and an extract from the Gettysburg Address hung above the TV, partly obscured by a glossy cardboard sign advertising adult movies. There were two large beds, side by side, and Grace collapsed on the one farthest from the door, while Annie went back out into the rain to seat a pilgrim. The horse seemed to be getting used to the rituals of the journey. Confined in the narrow stall of the trailer, he no longer erupted when Annie stepped into the cramped, protected space in front of him. He just edged back into the darkness and watched. She could feel his eyes on her while she hung up a new net of hay and carefully pushed his buckets of feed and water within reach. He would never touch them until she had gone. She sensed his simmering hostility and was both scared and excited by it, so that when she closed the door on him, her heart was pounding. When she got back to the room, Grace had undressed and was in bed. Her back was turned, and whether she was asleep or just pretending, Annie couldn't tell. "Grace," she said softly, "don't you want to eat?" There was no reaction. Annie thought about going alone to the restaurant, but couldn't face it. She took a long, hot bath, hoping the water would bring her comfort. All it brought her was doubt. It hung in the air with the steam, enfolding her. What on earth did she think she was doing, dragging these two wounded souls across a continent in some gruesome reprise of pioneer madness? Grace's silence and the remorseless emptiness of the spaces they had crossed made Annie feel suddenly terribly alone. To obliterate these thoughts, she slid her hands between her legs and felt herself. Worked at herself, refusing to concede to the initial stubborn numbness until at last her loins twitched and swam, and she was lost. That night she dreamed she was walking with her father along a snowy ridge, roped like mountaineers, though this was something they had never done. Below, on either side, sheer walls of rock and ice plunged to nothingness. They were on a cornice, a thin overhanging crust of snow, which her father said was safe. He was in front of her, and he turned to her and smiled the way he smiled in her favorite photograph, a smile which said with total confidence that he was with her and everything was all right. And as he did so, over his shoulder she saw a crack zigzagging toward them, and the lip of the cornice start to split away and tumble down the mountainside. She wanted to cry out, but couldn't. And the moment before the crack reached them, her father turned and saw it. And then he was gone, and Annie saw the rope between them snaking after him, and she realized the only way to save them both was to jump the other way. So she launched herself into the air on the other side of the ridge. But instead of feeling the rope jolt and hold, she just kept on falling, free falling into the void. When she woke, it was morning. They had slept late. Outside, it was raining even harder. Mount Rushmore and its stone faces were hidden in swirling cloud that the woman in reception said wasn't going to clear. Not far away, she said, there was another mountain carving they could maybe get a glimpse of, a giant figure of Crazy Horse. "Thanks," said Annie. "We've got our own." They had breakfast, checked out, and drove back up to the interstate. They crossed the state line into Wyoming and skirted south of Devil's Tower and Thunder Basin, then over the Powder River and up toward Sheridan, where at last the rain stopped. Increasingly, the pickups and trucks they saw were driven by men in cowboy hats. Some touched their brims or lifted a hand in grave salute. As they went by, the sun made rainbows in the plumes of their tail spray. It was late afternoon when they crossed into Montana, but Annie felt neither relief nor any sense of achievement. She had tried so hard not to let Grace's silence beat her. All day she had hopped stations on the radio and listened to Bible-thumping preachers, livestock reports, and more kinds of country music than she'd known existed. But it was no good. She felt herself compressed into an ever-shrinking space between the weight of her daughter's gloom and her own welling anger. At last it was too much to bear. Some 40 miles into Montana, neither looking nor caring where it led, she took an exit off the interstate. She wanted to park, but nowhere seemed right. There was a massive casino standing on its own, and as she looked, its neon sign flickered on, red and lurid in the fading light. She drove on up a hill, past a cafe, and a low straggle of stores with a dirt parking strip in front. Two Indians with long black hair and feathers in their high-crowned cowboy hats stood beside a battered pickup, watching the lariat and trailer approach. Something in their gaze unsettled her, and she kept on up the hill, took a right turn, and stopped. She switched off the ignition, and for a while sat very still. She could sense Grace behind her, watching. The girl's voice, when at last she spoke, was cautious.
"What's going on?"
"What?" Annie said sharply.
"It's closed, look."
There was a sign along the road that said, "National Monument, Little Bighorn Battlefield." Grace was right. According to the opening hours it gave, the place had closed an hour ago. It made Annie even angrier that Grace should so misjudge her mood to think she had come here deliberately like a tourist. She didn't trust herself to look at her. She just stared ahead and took a deep breath.
"How long is this going to go on, Grace?"
"What? You know what I mean. How long is it going to go on?" There was a long pause. Annie watched a ball of tumbleweed chase its own shadow down the road toward them. It brushed the side of the car as it went by. She turned to look at Grace, and the girl looked away and shrugged.
"I mean, is this it now?" Annie went on.
"We've come nearly 2,000 miles, and you sat there and you haven't spoken a word. So I just thought I'd ask, just so I know. Is this the way you and I are going to be now?" Grace was looking down, fiddling with her Walkman. She shrugged again.
"I don't know."
"Do you want us to turn around and go back home?" Grace gave a bitter little laugh.
"Well, do you?"
Grace lifted her eyes and looked sideways out of the window, trying to seem nonchalant, but Annie could see she was fighting tears. There was a clumping sound as Pilgrim shifted in the trailer.
"Because if that's what you want," suddenly Grace turned on her face savage and distorted. The tears were running now, and the failure to stop them doubled her fury.
"What the hell do you care?"
she screamed.
"You decide. You always do. You pretend you care what other people want, but you don't. It's just bullshit."
"Grace," Annie said gently, putting a hand out, but Grace smacked it away.
"Don't. Just leave me alone."
Annie looked at her for a moment, then opened the door and got out. She started walking, blindly, tilting her face to the wind. The road led up past a grove of pine trees to a parking lot and a low building, both deserted. She kept walking. She followed a path that curved up the hillside and found herself beside a cemetery enclosed by black iron railings. At the crest of the hill there was a simple stone monument, and it was here that Annie stopped. On this hillside, on a June day in 1876, George Armstrong Custer and more than 200 soldiers were cut to pieces by those they had sought to slaughter. Their names were etched in the stone. Annie turned to look down the hill at the scattered white tombstones. They cast long shadows in the last pale reach of the sun. She stood there and looked out across the vast rolling plains of wind-flattened grass that stretched away from this sorrowful place to a horizon where sorrow was infinite. And she started to weep. It would later strike her as strange that she should have come here by chance. Whether some other random place would have brought forth the tears she'd stemmed for so long, she never would know. The monument was a kind of cruel anomaly, honoring, as it did, the agents of genocide, while the countless graves of those they had butchered elsewhere lay forever unmarked. But the sense of suffering here and the presence of so many ghosts transcended all detail. It was simply a fitting place for tears. And Annie hung her head and wept them. She wept for Grace and for Pilgrim and for the lost souls of the children who'd died in her womb. Above all, she wept for herself and what she had become. All her life she had lived where she didn't belong. America wasn't her home, and nor when she went there now was England. In each country they treated her as if she came from the other. The truth was she came from nowhere. She had no home. Not since her father died. She was rootless, tribeless, adrift. Once this had seemed her greatest strength. She had a way of tapping into things. She could seamlessly adapt, insinuate herself into any group, any culture or situation. She knew instinctively what was required, who you needed to know, what you had to do to win. And in her work which had so long obsessed her, this gift had helped her win all that was worth winning. Now, since Grace's accident, it all seemed worthless. In the past 3 months, she had been the strong one, fooling herself that it was what Grace needed. The fact was she knew no other way to react. Having lost all connection with herself, she had lost it too with her child, and for this she was consumed with guilt. Action had become a substitute for feeling, or at least for the expression of it. And this was why, she now saw, she had launched herself into this lunatic adventure with Pilgrim. Annie sobbed until her shoulders ached. Then she slid her back down the cold stone of the monument and sat with her head in her hands. And there she stayed, until the sun dipped pale and liquid behind the distant snowy rim of the Bighorn Mountains, and the cottonwoods down by the river melted together in a single black scar. When she looked up, it was night, and the world was a lantern of sky. "Ma'am?" It was a park ranger. He had a flashlight, but kept its beam tactfully away from her face. "You okay there, ma'am?" Annie wiped her face and swallowed. "Yes, thank you," she said. "I'm fine." She got up. "Your daughter was getting kind of worried down there." "Yes, I'm sorry. I'm going now." He tipped his hat as she went. "Night, ma'am. You go safely now." She walked back down to the car, aware he was watching. Grace was asleep, or perhaps she was only pretending to be. Annie started the engine, switched on the lights, and made a turn at the top of the road. She looped back onto the interstate and drove through the night, all the way to Shoto. Part 3, Chapter 14. Two creeks ran through the Booker brothers' land, and they gave the ranch its name, the Double Divide. They flowed from adjacent folds of the mountain front, and in their first half mile they looked like twins. The ridge that ran between them here was low, at one point almost low enough for them to meet, but then it rose sharply in a rugged chain of interlocking bluffs, shouldering the creeks apart. Forced thus to seek their separate ways, they now became quite different. The northern one ran swift and shallow down a wide, uncluttered valley, Its banks, though sometimes steep, gave easy access to the cattle. Brook trout hung with their heads upstream in its breaks and eddies, while herons stalked its shingled beaches. The route the southern creek was forced to take was lusher, full of obstacles and trees. It wove through tangled thickets of Bebb's willow and red-stemmed dogwood, then disappeared a while in marsh. Lower down, meandering a meadow so flat that its loops linked back upon themselves, it formed a maze of still, dark pools and grassy islands whose geography was constantly arranged and rearranged by beavers. Ellen Booker used to say the creeks were like her two boys, Frank the North and Tom the South. That was until Frank, who was 17 at the time, remarked over supper one night that it wasn't fair because he liked beaver, too. His father told him to go wash his mouth out and send him to bed. Tom wasn't so sure his mother got the joke, but she must have because she never said it again. The house they called the Creek House, where first Tom and Rachel, then later Frank and Diane had lived, and which now was empty, stood on a bluff above a bend in the northern creek. From it you could look down the valley across the tops of cottonwood trees to the ranch house half a mile away, surrounded by whitewashed barns, stables, and corrals. The houses were linked by a dirt road that wound on up to the lower meadows where the cattle spent the winter. Now, in early April, most of the snow had gone from this lower part of the ranch. It lay only in shaded, rock-strewn gullies and among the pine and fir trees that dotted the north side of the ridge. Tom looked up at the creek house from the passenger seat of the old Chevy and wondered, as he often did, about moving in. He and Joe were on their way back from feeding the cattle, the boy expertly negotiating the potholes. Joe was small for his age and had to sit like a ramrod to see over the front. During the week, Frank did the feeding, but at weekends, Joe liked to do it, and Tom liked to help him. They'd unloaded the slabs of alfalfa and together enjoyed the sight and sound of the cows surging in with their calves to get it. "Can we go see Brody's foal?" Joe asked. "Sure we can. There's a kid at school says we should have imprint trained him." "Uh-huh. He says if you do it soon as they're born, it makes them real easy to handle later on." "Yep, that's what some folks say. There was this thing on the TV about a guy who does it with geese, too. He has his airplane, and the baby geese all grow up thinking it's their mom. He flies it, and they just follow." "Yeah, I heard about that. What do you think about all that stuff?" "Well, Joe, I don't know a whole lot about geese. Maybe it's okay for them to grow up thinking they're airplanes." Joe laughed. "But with a horse, I reckon first you have to let him learn to be a horse." They drove back down to the ranch and parked outside the long barn where Tom kept some of his horses. Joe's twin brothers, Scott and Craig, came running out of the house to meet them. Tom saw Joe's face fall. The twins were 9 years old, and because of their blonde good looks and the fact that they did everything in a noisy unison, they always got more attention than their brother. "You going to see the fall?" they yelled. "Can we come?" Tom put a big hand like a crane grab on each of their heads. "So long as you keep quiet, you can," he said. He led them into the barn and stood with the twins outside Brody's stall while Joe went in. Brody was a big 10-year-old quarter horse, a reddish bay. She pushed her muzzle toward Joe, who put a hand on it while he gently rubbed her neck. Tom liked to watch the boy around horses. He had an easy, confident way with them. The foal, a little darker than his mother, had been lying in the corner and was now struggling to his feet. He tottered on comical, stilted legs to the sheltering side of the mare, peeping around her rear end at Joe. The twins laughed. "He looks so funny," Scott said. "I've got a picture of you two at that age," said Tom, "and you know what? They look like bullfrogs," Joe said. The twins soon got bored and left. Tom and Joe turned the other horses out into the paddock behind the barn. After breakfast, they were going to start working with some of the yearlings. As they walked back to the house, the dogs started barking and ran out past them. Tom turned and saw a silver Ford Lariat coming over the end of the ridge and heading down the driveway toward them. There was just the driver in it, and as it got nearer, he could see it was a woman. "Your mom expecting company?" Tom asked. Joe shrugged. It wasn't until the car pulled up, with the dogs running around it still barking, that Tom recognized who it was. It was hard to believe. Joe saw his look.
"You know her?"
"I believe I do. But not what she's doing here." He told the dogs to hush and walked over. Annie got out of the car and came nervously toward him. She was wearing jeans and hiking boots and a huge cream-colored sweater that came halfway down her thighs. The sun behind made her hair flare red, and Tom realized how clearly he remembered those green eyes from the day at the stables. She nodded at him without quite smiling, a little sheepish.
"Mr. Booker, good morning."
"Well, good morning." They stood there for a moment. "Joe, this is Mrs. Graves. Joe here is my nephew." Annie offered the boy her hand.
"Hello, Joe. How are you?"
"Good."
She looked up at the valley, toward the mountains, then looked back at Tom.
"What a beautiful place."
"It is." He was wondering when she was going to get around to saying what on earth she was doing here, though he already had an idea. She took a deep breath.
"Mr. Booker, you're going to think this is insane, but you can probably guess why I've come here."
"Well, I kind of reckon you didn't just happen to be passing through." She almost smiled.
"I'm sorry just turning up like this, but I knew what you'd say if I phoned. It's about my daughter's horse."
"Pilgrim?"
"Yes. I know you can help him, and I came here to ask you, to beg you to have another look at him."
"Mrs. Graves,
please, just a look. It wouldn't take long."
Tom laughed. "What, to fly to New York?" He nodded at the Lariat. "Or were you counting on driving me there?"
"He's here, in Shoto."
Tom stared at her for a moment in disbelief. "You've hauled him all the way out here?" She nodded. Joe was looking from one of them to the other, trying to get the picture. Diane had stepped out onto the porch and stood there holding open the screen door, watching. "All on your own?" Tom asked.
"With Grace, my daughter."
"Just to have me take a look at him?"
"Yes."
"You guys coming in to eat?"
called Diane. "Who's the woman?" was what she really meant. Tom put his hand on Joe's shoulder. "Tell your mom I'm coming," he said. And as the boy went off, he turned back to Annie. They stood looking at each other for a moment. She gave a little shrug and at last smiled. He noticed how it made the corners of her mouth go down, but left untouched the troubled look in her eyes. He was being railroaded and wondered why he didn't mind. "Excuse me saying it, ma'am," he said, "but you sure as hell don't like taking no for an answer."
"No," Annie said simply. "I suppose I don't."
Grace lay on her back on the floor of the musty bedroom, doing her exercises and listening to the electronic bells of the Methodist church across the street. They didn't just chime the hour, they played whole tunes. She quite liked the sound, mainly because it was driving her mother crazy. Annie was down in the hall on the phone to the real estate agent about it. "Don't they know there are laws about this sort of thing?" she was saying. "They're polluting the air." It was the fifth time she had called him in 2 days. The poor man had made the mistake of giving her his home number, and Annie was ruining his weekend, bombarding him with complaints. The heating wasn't working. The bedrooms were damp. The extra phone line she'd asked for hadn't been installed. The heating still wasn't working. And now the bells. "It wouldn't be so bad if they played something half decent," she was saying. "It's ridiculous. The Methodists have all the good tunes." Yesterday, when Annie went out to the ranch, Grace had refused to go with her. After Annie left, she went out exploring. There wasn't much to explore. Shoto was basically one long main street with a railroad on one side and a grid of residential streets on the other. There was a dog parlor, a video store, a steakhouse, and a cinema showing a movie Grace had seen over a year ago. The town's only claim to fame was a museum where you could see dinosaur eggs. She went into a couple of stores, and the people were friendly but reserved. She was aware of others watching as she walked slowly back down the street with her cane. When she got back to the house, she felt so depressed she burst into tears. Annie had come back elated and told Grace that Tom Booker had agreed to come and see Pilgrim the following morning. All Grace said was, "How long have we got to stay in this dump?" The house was a big, rambling place faced with peeling pale blue clapboard and carpeted throughout in a stained yellow-brown shag pile. The sparse furniture looked as if it had been picked up in a yard sale. Annie was appalled when they first saw the place. Grace was delighted. Its glaring inadequacy was on her side, a perfect vindication. Secretly, she wasn't as opposed to this mission of her mother's as she made out. It was a relief, in fact, to get away from school and the tiring business of putting on a brave face all the time. But her feelings for Pilgrim were confused. They frightened her. It was best to block him right out of her head. Her mother, however, made this impossible. Her every action seemed to force Grace to confront the issue. She'd taken this whole thing on as if Pilgrim was hers, and he wasn't hers, he was Grace's. Of course Grace wanted him to get better, it was just that... It struck her then for the first time that maybe she didn't want him to get better. Maybe she blamed him for what had happened? No, that was stupid. Maybe she wanted him to be as she was, forever maimed. Why should he recover and not her? It wasn't fair. Stop it, stop it, she told herself. These whirling, crazy thoughts were her mother's fault, and Grace wasn't going to let them get a hold in her head. She redoubled the effort in her exercises until she felt the sweat trickle down her neck. She lifted her stump high in the air again and again, making the muscles ache in her right buttock and her thigh. She could look at this leg now and accept at last that it belonged to her. The scar was neat, no longer that angry, itching pink. Her muscles were coming back nicely, so much so that the sleeve of her prosthetic leg was starting to feel a little tight. She heard Annie hang up. "Grace, have you finished? He'll be here soon." Grace didn't reply, just let the words hang there. "Grace?" "Yeah, so what?" She could feel Annie's reaction, picture the irked look on her face giving way to resignation. She heard her sigh and go back into the drab dining room, which, as a first priority, of course, Annie had transformed into her office. Chapter 15. All Tom had promised was that he would go and have another look at the horse. After she had come all that way, it was the least he could do. But he'd made it a condition that he would go alone. He didn't want her looking over his shoulder, putting pressure on him. She was pretty good at that. He already knew. She had made him promise to drop by afterward and give her his verdict. He knew the Peterson place just outside Shoto, where she had Pilgrim stabled. They were nice enough people, but if the horse was as bad as when Tom last saw him, they wouldn't put up with him for long. Old man Peterson had the face of an outlaw, 3 days of grizzled beard and teeth as black as the tobacco he always chewed. He showed them in a mischievous grin when Tom pulled up in the Chevy.
"What's it they say? If you're looking for trouble, you've come to the right place. Damn near killed me getting him unloaded. Been kicking and hollering like a banshee ever since."
He led Tom down a muddy track past the rusting hulks of derelict cars to an old barn lined either side with stalls. The other horses had been turned out. Tom could hear Pilgrim long before they got there.
"Only fitted that door last summer," Peterson said. "He'd have had the old one down by now. Woman says you're going to sort him out for her."
"Oh, she did."
"Uh-huh. All I can say is, make sure you go see Bill Larson for a fitting first."
He roared with laughter and slapped Tom on the back. Bill Larson was the local undertaker. The horse was in even sorrier shape than when Tom last saw him. His front leg was so badly wasted, Tom wondered how he even managed to stand, let alone keep up the kicking.
"Must have been a nice-looking horse once," said Peterson.
"I reckon." Tom turned away. He'd seen enough. He drove back into Shoto and looked at the piece of paper on which Annie had written her address. When he pulled up outside the house and walked up to the front door, the church bells were playing a tune he hadn't heard since he was a kid in Sunday school. He rang the doorbell and waited. The face he saw when the door opened startled him. It wasn't that he'd been expecting the mother. It was the open hostility in the girl's pale, freckled face. He remembered the face from the photograph Annie had sent him, a happy girl and her horse. The contrast was shocking. He smiled. "You must be Grace." She didn't smile back, just nodded and stepped aside for him to come in. He took off his hat and waited while she shut the door. He could hear Annie talking in a room off the hallway.
"She's on the phone. You can wait in here."
She led the way into a bare, L-shaped living room. Tom looked down at her leg and the cane as he followed, making a mental note not to look again. The room was gloomy and smelled of damp. There were a couple of old armchairs, a sagging sofa, and a TV playing an old black-and-white movie. Grace sat down and went on watching it. Tom perched himself on an arm of one of the chairs. The door across the hallway was half open, and he could see a fax machine, a computer screen, and a tangle of wires. All he could see of Annie was a crossed leg and a boot that bobbed impatiently. She sounded pretty worked up about something.
"What?" He said, "What?" "I don't believe it. Lucy, I don't care. It's got nothing to do with Crawford. I'm the bloody editor, and that's the cover we go with."
Tom saw Grace raise her eyes to the ceiling and wondered if it was for his benefit. In the movie, an actress whose name he could never remember was on her knees, hanging on to James Cagney, begging him not to leave. They always did this, and Tom could never understand why they bothered.
"Grace, will you get Mr. Booker a coffee?" Annie shouted from the other room. "I'd like one, too."
She went back to her phone call. Grace flicked the TV off and got up, clearly irritated.
"It's okay, really," said Tom.
"She just made it."
She stared at him as if he'd said something rude.
"Okay, then, thank you. But you keep watching the movie and I'll get it."
"I've seen it. It's boring."
She picked up her cane and went off into the kitchen. Tom waited a moment, then followed. She shot him a glance when he came in and made more noise than she needed to with the cups. He walked over to the window.
"What does your mother do?"
"What?"
"Your mother. I wondered what line of work she was in."
"She edits a magazine."
She handed him a cup of coffee.
"Cream and sugar?"
"No, thanks." "Must be a pretty stressful kind of job."
Grace laughed. Tom was surprised by how bitter it sounded.
"Yeah, I guess you could say that."
There was an awkward silence. Grace turned away and was about to pour another cup, but instead she stopped and looked at him. He could see the surface of the coffee in the glass pot trembling from the tension in her. It was plain to see she had something important to say.
"Just in case she hasn't told you, I don't want to know anything about this, okay?"
Tom nodded slowly and waited for her to go on. She'd good as spat the words at him and was a little thrown by the calm reaction. She abruptly poured the coffee, but did it too fast so that she spilled some. She clunked the pot down on the table and picked up the cup, not looking at him as she went on.
"This whole thing was her idea. I think it's totally stupid. They should just get rid of him."
She stomped past him and out of the room. Tom watched her go, then he turned and looked out into the forlorn little backyard. A cat was eating something sinewy by an upturned garbage can. He had come here to tell this girl's mother for the last time that the horse was beyond help. It was going to be tough after they had come all this way. He had thought a lot about it since Annie's visit to the ranch. To be precise, he'd thought a lot about Annie and the sadness in those eyes of hers. It had occurred to him that if he took the horse on, he might be doing it not to help the horse, but to help her. He never did that. It was the wrong reason.
I'm sorry, it was important.
He turned to see Annie coming in. She was wearing a big denim shirt and her hair was combed back, still wet from the shower. It made her look boyish.
That's okay.
She went to get the coffee and topped up her cup. Then she came over to him and did the same to his without asking.
You've been to see him?
She put the coffee pot down but stayed standing in front of him. She smelled of soap or shampoo. Something expensive, anyway.
Yes, I just came from there.
And?
Tom still didn't know how he was going to break it to her, even as he started to speak.
Well, he's about as wretched as a horse can get.
He paused a moment and saw something flicker in her eyes. Then over her shoulder he saw Grace in the doorway, trying to look as if she didn't care and failing miserably. Meeting this girl just now had been like seeing the last picture of a triptych. The whole had become clear. All three, mother, daughter, and horse, were inextricably connected in pain. If he could help the horse, even a little, maybe he could help them all. What could be wrong with that? And truly, how could he walk away from such suffering? He heard himself say, "Maybe we could do something." He saw the relief surge into Annie's face.
"Now hold on, ma'am, please. That was only a maybe. Before I could even think about it, I need to know something. It's a question for Grace here."
He saw the girl stiffen. "You see, when I work with a horse, it's no good just me doing it. It doesn't work that way. The owner needs to be involved, too. So, here's the deal. I'm not sure I can do anything with old Pilgrim, but if you'll help, I'm prepared to give it a go." Grace gave that bitter little laugh again and looked away as if she couldn't believe he could make such a dumb suggestion. Annie looked at the floor.
"You have a problem with that, Grace?" Tom said.
She looked at him with what was no doubt meant as contempt, but when she spoke, her voice quavered.
"Isn't it, like, obvious?"
Tom considered this for a moment, then shook his head.
"Nope, I don't think it is. Anyway, that's the deal. Thanks for the coffee."
He put his cup down and walked toward the door. Annie looked at Grace, who turned away into the living room. Then Annie came hurrying after him into the hall.
"What would she have to do?"
"Just be there. Help out, be involved." Something told him he shouldn't mention riding. He put his hat on and opened the front door. He could see the desperation in Annie's eyes.
"It's cold in here," he said. "You ought to get the heating checked out."
He was about to step out when Grace appeared in the living room doorway. She didn't look at him. She said something, but it was so low he couldn't catch it.
"I'm sorry, Grace."
She shifted uncomfortably, her eyes flicking sideways.
"I said, okay, I'll do it."
And she turned away and went back into the room. Diane had cooked a turkey and was carving it as if it deserved it. One of the twins tried picking a piece and got his hand slapped. He was supposed to be ferrying the plates over from the sideboard to the table where everyone else was already seated.
"What about the yearlings?" she said. "I thought that was the whole idea of not doing clinics, so you could work with your own horses for a change."
"There'll be time for that," said Tom. He couldn't understand why Diane seemed so riled.
"Who does she think she is coming out here like that, just assuming she can force you into it? I think she's got one hell of a nerve. Get off!"
She tried to slap the boy again, but this time he got away with the meat. Diane raised the carving knife.
"Next time you get this, okay? Frank, don't you think she's got a nerve?"
"Oh, hell, I don't know. Seems to me it's up to Tom. Craig, will you pass the corn, please?"
Diane made up the last plate for herself and came and sat down. They all went quiet for Frank to say grace.
"Anyway," Tom went on after it was said, "Joe here's going to be helping me with the yearlings. Is that right, Joe?"
"Sure. Not while you're at school, you're not," Diane said.
Tom and Joe exchanged a look. No one spoke for a while, everyone just getting on with helping themselves to vegetables and cranberry sauce. Tom hoped Diane would let the matter drop, but she was like a dog with a bone.
I guess they'll want feeding and all out here all day long.
I don't reckon they'll expect that, Tom said.
What, they'll go 40 miles into Shoto every time they want a cup of coffee?
Tea, Frank said. Diane shot him an unfriendly look.
Huh?
Tea. She's English. They drink tea. Come on, Diane, give the guy a break.
Does the girl's leg look funny?
Scott said through a mouthful of turkey.
Funny? Joe shook his head. You are one weird kid.
No, I mean, is it like made of wood or what?
Just eat your food, Scott, okay? Frank said. They ate in silence for a while. Tom could see Diane's mood hanging above her like a cloud. She was a tall, powerful woman whose face and spirit had been hardened by the place she lived in. Increasingly, as she moved into her mid-40s, she had about her an air of lost opportunity. She'd grown up on a farm near Great Falls, and it was Tom who'd first met her. They dated a few times, but he made it clear he wasn't ready to settle down, and was, anyway, so seldom around that it just petered out. So Diane married the younger brother instead. Tom was fond of her, though sometimes, especially since his mother moved to Great Falls, he found her a touch overprotective. He worried now and again that she gave him more attention than she did Frank. Not that Frank ever seemed to notice.
When you figuring on branding? He asked his brother.
Weekend after next, if the weather picks up. On a lot of ranches, they left it until later, but Frank branded in April, because the boys liked to help and the calves were still small enough for them to handle. They always made an event of it. Friends came over to help, and Diane laid on a spread for everyone afterward. It was a tradition Tom's father had begun, and one of many Frank kept going. Another was how they still used horses for much of the work other ranchers now used vehicles for. Rounding up cattle on motorcycles wasn't the same somehow. Tom and Frank had always seen these things the same way. They never disagreed about the way the ranch was run, nor anything else for that matter. This was partly because Tom thought of the place as more Frank's than his. It was Frank who'd stayed here all these years while he traveled doing his horse clinics, and Frank had always been the better businessman and knew more about cattle than he would ever know. The two of them were close and easy together, and Frank was genuinely thrilled about Tom's plans to get more seriously into horse rearing because it meant he'd be around the place more. Though the cattle were mainly Frank's and the horses Tom's, they discussed things and helped each other out whenever they could. Last year, when Tom was off doing a chain of clinics, it was Frank who had supervised the building of an arena and exercise pool that Tom had designed for the horses. Tom was aware suddenly that one of the twins had asked him a question.
Sorry, what was that?
Is she famous?
It was Scott.
Is who famous, for heaven's sakes? Diane snapped.
The woman from New York.
Diane didn't give Tom the chance to answer.
Have you heard of her?
She asked the boy. He shook his head.
Well, then she isn't famous, is she? Eat your food.
Chapter 16. The northern edge of Shoto was guarded by a 13.5-foot-tall dinosaur. Pedants knew it to be an Albertosaurus, but to everyone else it looked pretty much like a regular T-Rex. It kept watch from the parking lot of the Old Trail Museum, and you got to see it just after you passed the sign on Route 89 saying, "Welcome to Shoto. Nice people, great country." Conscious perhaps of the immediate damper this might put on such a welcome, the sculptor had shaped the creature's steak knife teeth into a knowing grin. The effect was unsettling. You couldn't tell if it wanted to eat you or lick you to death. 4 times a day, for 2 weeks now, Annie had traversed this reptilian gaze as she drove to and from the Double Divide. They would go out at noon after Grace had done some schoolwork or spent a grueling morning at the physical therapist's. Annie would drop her off at the ranch, come back, hit the phones and the fax, then head out again at about 6 as she was doing now to collect her. The trip took about 40 minutes, and she enjoyed it, especially since the weather had turned the evening ride. For 5 days, the skies had been clear, and they were bigger and bluer than she'd ever known skies could be. After the afternoon frenzy of phone calls to New York, driving out into this landscape was like plunging into an immense, calming pool. The trip was a long L-shape, and for the first 20 miles north along 89, Annie's was often the only car. The plains stretched endlessly away to her right, and as the sun arced low toward the Rockies on her left, the winter-worn grass around her turned to pale gold. She turned west onto the unmarked gravel road that went in a straight line for another 15 miles to the ranch in the mountain wall beyond. The lariat left a cloud of dust behind it that drifted slowly away in the breeze. Curlews strutted on the road in front, then glided away at the last moment into the pasture. Annie lowered the visor against the sun's dazzle and felt something inside her quicken. In the last few days, she had started coming out to the ranch a little earlier so that she could watch Tom Booker at work. Not that the real work with Pilgrim had started yet. So far, it had been mostly physical therapy, building up the horse's wasted shoulder and leg muscles in the swimming pool. Round and round he swam, with a look in his eyes as if he were being chased by crocodiles. He was staying out on the ranch now, in a stall right by the pool, and the only close contact Tom had so far had with him was getting him in and out of the water. Even so, it was dangerous enough. Yesterday, Annie had stood beside Grace and watched him get Pilgrim from the pool. The horse hadn't wanted to come out, fearing a trap, so Tom had walked down the ramp till he was up to his waist. Pilgrim had thrashed around and soaked him and even reared up over him. But Tom was totally unfazed. It seemed miraculous to Annie how the man could stand so calmly close to death. How could one calculate such margins? Pilgrim, too, had seemed baffled by this lack of fear, and soon staggered out and let himself be ushered to his stall. Tom came back to Grace and Annie and stood dripping before them. He took off his hat and poured the water from its brim. Grace started to laugh, and he gave her a wry look that made her laugh even more. Then he turned to Annie and shook his head. "She's a heartless woman, this daughter of yours," he said. "What she doesn't know is next time she's the one going in." The sound of Grace's laughter had stayed in Annie's head ever since. On the way back to Shoto, Grace had told her what they'd been doing with Pilgrim and the questions Tom had asked about him. She had told her about Bronte's foal, about Frank and Diane and the boys, how the twins were a pain, but Joe was all right. It was the first time she'd talked freely and happily since they'd left New York, and Annie had to try hard not to overreact and to just let it happen as though it were nothing special. It hadn't lasted. Driving past the dinosaur, Grace fell silent, as if it reminded her how nowadays she behaved toward her mother. But at least it was a start, thought Annie. The lariat's tires scrunched now on the gravel as she came around the ridge and curved down into the valley under the wooden double D sign that marked the start of the ranch's driveway. Annie could see horses running in the big open arena by the stables, and as she got nearer, she could see Tom riding among them. In one hand he had a long stick with an orange flag on the end, and he was waving it at them, making them run away from him. There were maybe a dozen colts in there, and mostly they kept close to each other. There was one among them, though, who was always alone, and now Annie could see it was Pilgrim. Grace was leaning on the rail next to Joe and the twins, all of them watching. Annie parked and walked over to them, ruffling the heads of the dogs, who no longer barked when she arrived. Joe smiled at her and was the only one who said hello. "What's going on?" Annie asked. "Oh, he's just driving him around some." Annie leaned on the rail beside him and watched. The colts bolted and swerved from one end of the arena to the other, making long shadows on the sand and kicking up amber clouds of it that trapped the slanting sun. Tom moved Rimrock effortlessly after them, sometimes stepping sideways or backward to block them or open up a gap. Annie hadn't seen him ride before. The horse's white-socked feet made intricate steps without any visible guidance, steered, so it seemed to Annie, by Tom's thoughts alone. It was as if he and the horse were one. She couldn't take her eyes off him. As he came past, he tipped his hat and smiled. Annie? It was the first time he hadn't called her ma'am or Mrs. Graves, and to hear him unprompted speak her name pleased her, made her feel accepted. She watched him move off toward Pilgrim, who had stopped, like all the others, at the far end of the arena. The horse stood separate and was the only one sweating. The scars on his face and chest stood out in the sunlight, and he was tossing his head and snorting. He seemed as troubled by the other horses as he was by Tom. "What we're doing here, Annie, is trying to get him to learn how to be a horse again. All the others already know, see? That's how they are in the wild, herd animals. When they've got a problem, like they have now, with me and this flag, they look to each other. But old Pilgrim here is plumb forgotten. I'm the rock and they're the hard place. He thinks he hasn't got a friend in the world. Turn them all loose in the mountains and these guys would be fine. Poor old Pilgrim, though, he'd be bear bait. It's not that he doesn't want to make friends, he just doesn't know how." He moved Rimrock in on them and lifted the flag sharply, making it crack in the air. The colts all broke away to the right, and this time, instead of breaking left like before, Pilgrim went after them. As soon as he was clear of Tom, though, he separated and again came to a halt on his own. Tom grinned. "He'll get there." The sun had long gone by the time they had Pilgrim back in his stall, and it was getting cold. Diane called the boys in for their supper, and Grace went in with them to pick up a coat she had left in the house. Tom and Annie walked slowly over to the lariat. Annie felt suddenly very aware of their being alone together. For a while, neither of them spoke. An owl flew low over their heads toward the creek, and Annie watched it melt into the dark of the cottonwoods. She felt Tom's eyes on her and turned to look at him. He smiled, calmly and quite without embarrassment. And the look he gave her wasn't the look of a virtual stranger, but of someone who'd known her for a very long time. Annie managed to smile back, and was relieved to see Grace coming toward them from the house. "We're branding here tomorrow," Tom said, "if you two want to come and give a hand." Annie laughed. "I think we'd just get in the way," she said. He shrugged. "Maybe. But as long as you don't get in the way of the branding iron, it doesn't matter too much. Even if you do, it's a nice-looking mark. Back in the city, you might be proud of it." Annie turned to Grace and could see she was keen but trying not to look it. She turned back to Tom. "Okay, why not?" she said. He told her they'd be starting around 9 the next morning, but they could show up whenever they liked. Then they said goodnight. As she pulled away up the driveway, Annie looked in the rearview mirror. He was still standing there, watching them go. Chapter 17. Tom rode up one side of the valley and Joe the other. The idea was to pick up stragglers, but the cows needed little more inducement. They could see the old Chevy down in the meadow where it always parked at feeding time, and they could hear Frank and the twins hollering and banging the bag of cow cake on its lowered rear end for them to come and get it. They streamed down from the hills, calling in reply, while their calves scrambled after them, calling too, anxious not to be left behind. Tom's father used to raise pure Herefords, but for some years now Frank had raised a Black Angus Hereford cross. The Angus cows were good mothers and suited the climate better, because their udders were black, not pink, like the Herefords, so they didn't get burned by the sun bouncing off the snow. Tom watched for a while as they moved away from him down the hill. Then he turned Rimrock to the left and dropped over into the shaded bed of the creek. Steam rose off the water into the warming air, and a dipper took off and flew straight upstream ahead of them, fast and so low that its slate wings almost skimmed the surface. Down here, the calling of the cattle was muted, then lost in the soft splashing of the horse's feet as he moved up to the top of the meadow. Sometimes along here, a calf would get tangled in the thick willow scrub. But today they found nothing, and Tom eased Rimrock back onto the bank, then loped him up into the sun at the top of the ridge and stopped. He could see Joe on his brown and white paint pony way over on the other side of the valley. The boy waved, and Tom waved back. Below, the cattle were funneling down to the Chevy, flooding around it so that it looked from here like a boat on a seething pool of black. The twins were tossing out a few pellets of cake to keep the cows interested, while Frank clambered back into the driver's seat and started to pull slowly away back down the meadow. Lured by the cake, the cattle surged after it. From this ridge, you could see right down the valley to the ranch and the corrals to which the cattle were now being led. And as Tom looked, he saw what he realized he had been looking out for all morning. Annie's car was coming down the driveway, leaving a low, gray wake of dust. As it curved in front of the ranch house, the sun flashed on its windshield. More than a mile separated him from the two figures that got out of the car. They were small and quite featureless. But Tom could picture Annie's face as if she were beside him. He saw her as she'd been last evening, as she watched the owl before she sensed him watching her. She had looked so lost and beautiful that he'd wanted to take her in his arms. "She's another man's wife," he'd told himself as the lariat's taillights went off up the driveway. But it hadn't stopped him thinking about her. He nudged Rimrock forward and moved off down the hill to follow the cattle. The air over the corral hung heavy with dust and the smell of scorched flesh. Separated from their mothers, who kept up a constant calling, the calves were moved through a series of connecting pens until they found themselves in a narrow chute from which there was no return. Emerging from here, one by one, they were clamped and lowered sideways onto a table where four pairs of hands went immediately to work. Before they knew it, they'd been given a shot, a yellow insect tag in one ear, a growth pellet in the other, then a burn on the butt with a branding iron. Then the table went vertical again, off came the clamp, and suddenly they were free. They tottered off in a daze toward the call of their mothers, at whose udders at last they found comfort. All of this was witnessed with a lazy, regal disinterest by their fathers, five enormous Hereford bulls who lay chewing in an adjoining pen. It was witnessed by Annie with something approaching horror. She could see Grace felt the same. The calves squealed terribly and got what little revenge they could by spurting shit down their attackers' boots or kicking any careless shin they found. Some of the neighbors who had come to help had brought children along, and those big or bold enough were trying their hand at roping and wrestling the smaller calves. Annie saw Grace watching them and thought what a terrible mistake it was to have come. There was such an extreme physicality about it all. It only seemed to make her own child's disability more blatant. Tom must have read this on Annie's face because he came over and quickly found her a job. He put her to work in the feeder pen to the chute alongside a grinning giant with reflector sunglasses and a T-shirt that said Serial Killer. He introduced himself as Hank and gave Annie a handshake that made her knuckles crack. He said he came from the next ranch down the valley. "Our friendly neighborhood psycho," Tom said.
"It's okay, I already ate," Hank confided to Annie.
As she got to work, Annie saw Tom go over to Grace, put his arm around her shoulders and lead her off. Though to where, Annie had no time to see because a calf trod on her foot, then kicked her hard on the knee. She yelped and Hank laughed and showed her how to shove them into the chute without getting too bruised or shat upon. It was hard work, and she had to concentrate, and soon, what with Hank's jokes and the warm spring sunshine, she started to feel better. Later, when she had a moment to look, she saw Tom had taken Grace right to the front line and had her wielding the branding iron. To begin with, she kept her eyes closed, but soon he got her thinking so hard about her technique that all squeamishness vanished. "Don't press too hard," Annie heard him say. He was standing behind Grace with his hands resting gently on her upper arms. "Just let it drop down lightly." Flames flared up as the red-hot head of the iron touched the calf's hide. "That's good. Firm but gentle. It hurts, but he'll get over it. Now let it roll a little. Good. Now lift." "Grace, that's a perfect brand. Best double D of the day." Everyone cheered.
The girl's face was flushed and her eyes were shining. She laughed and made a little bow. Tom saw Annie looking and grinned and pointed at her.
Your turn next, Annie.
By late afternoon, all but the smallest calves were branded, and Frank announced it was time to eat. Everyone started heading for the ranch house, the younger children running on ahead, whooping. Annie looked around for Grace. No one had said anything about them being invited, and Annie felt it was time to leave. She saw Grace up ahead, walking to the house with Joe, the two of them chatting easily about something. Annie called her name, and she turned.
"We have to go now," Annie said.
"What? Why?"
"Yeah, why? You're not allowed to go."
It was Tom. He'd come up alongside her. They were beside the bullpen. The two of them had hardly spoken all day. Annie shrugged.
"Well, you know, it's getting late."
"Yeah, I know. And you've got to get back and feed the fax machine and make all those calls and things, right?"
The sun was behind him, and Annie put her head on one side and squinted at him, giving him a look. Men didn't normally tease her like this. She liked it.
"But you see, there's kind of a tradition here," he went on, "that whoever makes the best brand has to give a speech after dinner."
"What?"
said Grace.
"That's right. Or drink 10 jugs of beer. So, Grace, you better go on in and get yourself ready."
Grace looked at Joe to make sure it was a joke. Tom nodded toward the house, deadpan.
"Joe, you better show her the way."
Joe led her off, doing his best not to grin.
"If you're sure we're invited,"
said Annie.
"You're invited."
"Thank you."
"You're welcome." They smiled at each other, and the silence between them was filled for a few moments by the lowing of cattle. Their calls were gentler now that the frenzy of the day had passed. It was Annie who first felt the need to speak. She looked at the bulls lazing in the last of the sunshine.
"Who'd be a cow when you could lie around like these guys all day?" she said.
Tom looked at them and nodded.
"Yep, they spend all summer making love and winter just lying around and eating."
He paused, considering something, as he watched them. "On the other hand, not too many of them get to do it. Get born as a bull and you've got a 99% chance of getting castrated and served up as hamburger. On balance, I reckon I'd choose being a cow."
This ends Disc 5.